I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And if you've followed me for a while, you might know that I periodically look at British life during the 1930s, various aspects of it. And today we're diving back into Britain's War by Daniel Todman. The first volume of it is 1937 to 41. Daniel Todman gives us a big contextual picture of British life before the war, very, very detailed, very, very rich and very, very thorough. And in this section, he explores working class life. Some time ago, I was sort of almost worried to say how far back. I normally say a couple of podcasts ago, and it turns out it was like 2 years ago. But some time ago, I looked at the previous chapter of middle-class life during the 30s. And here we look at the lives of working-class people. And Daniel Todman writes, "Although the middle classes were expanding and dominant, the UK remained an overwhelmingly working-class country. Three-quarters of the population depended on the income earned in wage labour. In terms of numbers, it was a nation of factory hands, machinists, transport workers, dockers, shop assistants, farm labourers and domestic servants. The working classes, too, were changing as a result of the alterations in the economy. The percentage of the workforce employed in the staple industries fell during the 1930s as younger miners, shipwrights and mill workers left their hometowns for more certain jobs in the new manufacturing sectors. Across industry, the proportion of skilled workers was slowly declining as production line technology replaced artisanal aptitude." So this is one of the real interesting transitions during the 1930s. The Great Depression in Great Britain is regionalised. So the areas where the staple industries of shipbuilding, cotton, steel and coal had dominated, they were mainly hit hardest. Whereas areas where new light manufacturing industries were emerging seemed to be quite resistant to the Great Depression, and in some parts of the country, particularly Oxfordshire, for example, where there were the new motorworks, Cowley, employment actually rose. In 1937, the year of the coronation of George VI, living standards actually increased by that point in the 1930s. Wages had risen after the First World War, and while working hours had declined, and the state's provision of welfare for the least well-off improved, it meant that working-class people in work had more money, more leisure time, and a more robust safety net than previously they had had. The idea that we have about the 1930s of its uniform bleakness, actually, we have to make that more nuanced than by 1937, of course, the Great Depression for Britain is over. It ends in 34-35. And so in the second half of the 1930s, life is in many ways is improving for the poorest. This didn't mean that working class people could enjoy the luxuries of bourgeois life. They were unable to afford cars or the kinds of labour-saving devices in middle-class homes. Working-class people kind of were the labour-saving devices in middle-class homes. The ability to afford, if you're not even the kind of service staff, but a housekeeper or a cook, enabled a middle-class housewife to be able to do good charitable works as they were socially and culturally pressured to do or sort of inclined to do. And it was all done, basically, as a result of working-class labour. But disposable income meant a better diet, clothes, home furnishings, cigarettes, transport, mainly bus travel or train travel, the ability to afford things like radios, bicycles, or to be more stable in being able to pay rent. In the 1930s, a mixture of better food, better housing, and advances in medical treatment meant that across the board, for most working class people, health improved. There are some shocking stories in Juliet Gardner's The 30s, An Intimate Portrait, An Intimate History, of malnutrition during the Great Depression, of women particularly suffering, as what they would tend to do in highly recession-hit communities, is make sure that the husband and the children ate first, the rationale being, well, the husband is the breadwinner. Obviously, kind of the sorts of values that we would find totally unacceptable today, but values that were entirely rational and it seemed entirely reasonable then. And there is one story of an inquest of a woman who essentially just drops dead from acute malnutrition, but from ongoing and persistent undernourishment and perhaps congenital problems and dies. So, you know, this optimistic picture we must always balance by the fact that this is talking really about the end of the 1930s, not the height of the Great Depression. The rate of infant mortality fell nationally from 76 per 1,000 live births in 1929 to 55 per 1,000 in 1938, although the rate of maternal mortality in the 1930s was higher than it had been at the start of the century. Workers, by and large, in 1937, didn't have the statutory right to holiday, but the fall in working hours meant an increase in leisure time. And this creates industries based around leisure pursuits. Cinema, popular sports, the dance hall, greyhound racing. In the 1930s, greyhound racing after football is the second most popular participatory sport in Great Britain. It was phenomenally popular. Places like Walthamstow Dog Tracks and White City being kind of epicentres of the sport. And of course, leisure time meant a greater focus on the domestic sphere, on private life. These are trends which really intensify after World War II. The 1950s sees this huge explosion in this notion of the return to the private world, where people have more disposable income and they can do things to their homes. They can focus on the garden or the allotment. And there is a greater interest in these sorts of things, and of course greater leisure time. Most working class people didn't exist in quite the same economy as the middle classes. Working class ownership of bank accounts is relatively rare. Savings are done through what we refer to as the friendly societies, which were savings clubs, where the friendly society collector would come door to door and take cash savings or cash from householders each week, and there would be a pay book, and people could draw out of the fund when they needed to. Life insurance policies worked on the same basis. So the there was a kind of a working class culture of self provision for ill health, for sudden death, for the needs that would normally be supplied after the war by a national health service. The average weekly household income was something like about £4. But the ability to save and the ability to put money away was fairly limited. Two-thirds of adults who died in Britain in 1934, for example, left total assets, that's cash and valuables and property and everything else, of less than £100. Throughout the country, working class home ownership remained very, very rare. Home ownership for a tiny proportion of the working class was seen, and rightly so, as being the ladder out of poverty and destitution. The better paid working classes could afford the rents that were needed to be paid on one of the new suburban estates, where a million new council homes had been built since 1918 in Lloyd George's post-war drive for kind of homes for heroes, which sort of both did and didn't really emerge. The majority of working class families lived in the urban heartlands, many in sort of densely packed terraced houses. You just think of the kind of the East End of London, or the docks of Liverpool, or here in Cardiff, the Dockland districts, which serviced the great coal port that is now Cardiff Bay. Those sorts of communities were still the kind of the epicentres of working class life. They were close to mills and factories, and of course docks, and clustered along streets that were full of rich in kind of social life. Often there was little room indoors in fairly cramped houses, so people partly lived then, carried out their social lives in the street. And there was a kind of a sense of solidarity. Part of the reason for that was that, not necessarily that working class people are any more gregarious or friendly than anybody else.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
But that communities that were forced to live together or kind of crammed into small districts had to have a way of socially regulating themselves, that everybody knew everybody's business, and that people who transgressed against sort of social or behavioural norms were either faced the kind of the disapproval of the community, or their behaviour was resolved in other ways. I'll give you a personal example, a story of my grandmother who lived in Stockport along with her family, and my grandfather, who worked as a milliner. And then in the hat making business, on the factory floor. One evening, she recounted the story of how a man who was known to hit his wife on the street was talked about for a long, long time, until the women of the street went round. They all took their biggest stainless steel pans and went round to his house and beat the living daylights out of him, and it was seen as there to be no need to call the police, no need to deal with outsiders. The community took care of its own business, and this is the sort of tight-knit culture that tight-knit communities and physically cramped communities tended to create. Daniel Tobin refers to it as a neighbourliness that was as supportive as it was intrusive, and it was much missed by the emigrants to the new estates. So people who left this lifestyle, who left these communities, often felt, you know, they had moved to nicer accommodation in new council estates, but often felt lonely, often felt that they had been removed from their community. After the Second World War, the bombed out districts of places like the East End of London or the Docklands of Liverpool saw large amounts of slum clearances, and these terraced communities lost forever, and families who were moved out to new towns and estates far away from where they were originally from often found it very, very difficult to cope with life without the extended family and the community. Working class women worked before marriage, and the reason why they were so able to find work was that particularly the new manufacturing industries had a huge thirst for cheap, non-unionised labour, and this gave the opportunity for young women particularly to increase their spending power. and it also gave them an alternative to domestic service, and domestic service was by far the most hated profession that working class people could find themselves in. It was uniformly resented, but for particularly for working class women, was by the 1930s the biggest source of employment in the country. And I think something very interesting begins to happen in the 1920s and the 1930s, that young unmarried women who were normally in sweated labour or in service have disposable income, perhaps really for the first time, and as a result were able to make choices and decisions and access consumer goods and pleasures that they had never experienced before. The enjoyment of being able to go out for go out to a music hall, or go out for a dance to a dance hall, or go to the cinema, and it meant that there were alternatives to the pressure to quickly marry and have children. Of course, women did quickly marry, by and marry early, particularly working class women marry early in the 1930s. But very often, what you tend to find is social and political change takes a decade or two to gestate, and so the social changes of the 1950s, the 1930s. Really begin to manifest themselves after the Second World War, perhaps in the 50s and the 1960s, when people are able to look at one or two generations worth of positive change. Marriage and motherhood, writes Daniel Tobin, meant withdrawal from the formal economy to the hard toil of washing, cooking, cleaning and child-rearing. The time that allowed middle-class women to volunteer their efforts to good causes was run for them by the by their employment of working-class cooks and maids. Working-class families were smaller than they had been a generation before, but they remained typically larger than those of the middle class. Relatively few working-class children were educated beyond the senior classes of elementary school. The declining number who won a grammar school scholarship in competition against the offspring of the sharp-elbowed lower middle class, gained a passport to the ranks of clerkdom or industrial expertise. But most families thought it better for their children to get jobs rather than ideas above their station. So there was a great deal of sort of internal migration across Britain in the 1930s as a result of the decline of traditional industries. People flowed from old manufacturing heartlands towards new factories in central and southern England. Here again in Wales, there was a migration down what would now be the M4 corridor towards London. And the commuter towns on the edges of London, Reading, Slough and places like that, where light manufacturing and light industry could be found, there were significant numbers of Welsh families who moved there from the poverty-stricken Welsh valleys where the coal mining industries had collapsed to find new opportunities in any kind of work that was available and that would actually turn out to be kind of easier and less arduous work than coal mining. It's important, of course, not to see working class life as homogenous, that there were various different working classes in Great Britain and working classes who didn't necessarily look upon one another entirely favourably all the time. And once again, Daniel Tobin writes, regionally, working class lives differed dramatically between the long-apprenticed, highly skilled pits, factories and slipways of the traditional staple industries and the more antiseptic assembly lines of the new industries with fewer skilled workers. And the most rustic countryside where an ageing population was isolated from both the hum of the city and the boons of mains, water and electricity. Locally, working-class neighbourhoods were often separated by distinctions between the self-consciously respectable, church or chapel-going, sober and law-abiding, and those they thought rough, poorer, less observant, harder drinking, and probably headed for a bad end. The key distinction in working-class life was the extent of union membership and employment. Trade unions were the most fundamental aspect of working class organisation, political and economic, but they were important aspects of working class social life. They were a means of distributing for working class people education, leisure activities, aspects of social welfare, and workplace representation. They formed, obviously, a fundamental part of the labour movement alongside the Labour Party and the cooperative movement. And the union leaders were, you know, far more important national figures than they are now. They're people such as Walter Citrine, who was the General Secretary of the TG, the Trade Union Congress, and Ernest Bevin, head of the Transport and General Workers Union. And in some aspects of the economy, there was a kind of a divide between those workers who were employed, those workers who had lost their jobs during the Great Depression and never really regained them. And it's important sometimes not to overstate the extent of working class solidarity. There were among some portions of the employed working classes an idea that really those who had been left behind or those who had lost their jobs, whilst it was unfortunate, they had to look after themselves. Or there was among some working class, some employed working class people, a kind of a suspicion of the marches, the people who took part in the hunger marches of the early 1930s. That said, there was obviously an immense degree of compassion and solidarity and sympathy, and it was normally working class communities that came out to meet the Jarrow marches and the other hunger marches in the first half of the 1930s. Anyway, we're going to continue looking at Britain during the 1930s and gradually work towards our understanding of the social context of Britain on the eve of the Second World War. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Do remember to support our Patreon if you can, and have yourselves a great week, and we'll broadcast you again at some point in the next 7 days. All the best, bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.